This is Emergency Medicine Cases, EM Quick Hits Podcast, and I'm your host, Dr. Anton Hellman.
EM Cases is brought to you by SHREMI, the Schwartz-Reisman Emergency Medicine Institute. That's a nonprofit organization dedicated to improving EM care through high-quality research and education.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are intended for general information and educational purposes only and should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any medical condition, nor should they be used as a substitute for medical advice from a qualified practicing physician. Unless stated otherwise, the opinions expressed by the host or guests are made in their individual capacity, not on behalf of the Institute nor Medicine Cases.
First, a word from our sponsor, Metricade, the experts in complex physician scheduling since 2012. I've been using Metricade's incredible scheduling system for a decade, and it's been a game changer for me and my colleagues. Shift work comes with its challenges, but Metricade helps minimize the drawbacks by ensuring a fair distribution of shifts while integrating circadian-friendly rhythm recovery time into its methodology. Less sleep deprivation means I can be a better EM doc on shift and still have energy for life outside the hospital. Check out metricade.com/emcases to make your schedule fair and improve your sleep.
This episode is brought to you by Paratus, your ultimate assistant for every emergency. Built on the trusted foundation of Easy Recess, Paratus brings you intelligent search, a complete library of procedures and protocols, and Atoms, your assistant to obtain the right information when seconds count. Discover Paratus today at paratusmedical.com/emcases and be ready for anything.
It's my pleasure to have back on the show Dr. Deb Schoenfeld, pediatric EM educator for a Best of University of Toronto EM Quick Hit. Welcome back, Dr. Schoenfeld.
Thanks for having me.
Let's jump right into a case from Janus General. I understand that you had a case of a 12-year-old boy who came in with fever and back pain.
I do. So this case involved a 12-year-old male who was brought in with 5 days of just feeling unwell, some myalgias and fever, and 2 days of some gradually worsening back pain. He actually was brought in because he reported to his parents this afternoon that he hadn't actually urinated since the night prior, and that's really what prompted them to bring him into the emergency department. When he was asked about these urinary symptoms, he had a pretty typical adolescent response and offered something along the lines of, I don't know, it just feels weird when I pee. He saw his family doctor actually at the onset of illness, of this febrile illness, and his family doctor did some basic testing, and actually they got a call yesterday that he had a positive monospot test.
All right. So if this was an adult, I mean, as soon as you put back pain and fever together, worst things first, I would think, you know, they've got a discitis or an osteomyelitis, or, you know, I'm asking about IV drug use and things like that, immunocompromise, and then common things being common, you know, pyelonephritis. But this boy was positive for mono, which is a bit weird. And of course, kids aren't just little adults. So what happened next?
So he spent about 6 hours in the emergency department. He eventually had an abdominal ultrasound, which showed normal kidneys and made a mention of about 500 cc's of urine in his bladder. During this 6-hour ED course, he eventually was able to go to the bathroom, squeeze out a bit of urine, about an ounce of urine, which he gave us for testing. We dipped it, and it was negative for leukocytes and nitrites.
Okay, so now I'm more worried about the spine. But again, this kid had mono, and I'm assuming this child got an MRI?
Yep. He eventually did get an MRI. It did not show discitis or an epidural abscess or osteomyelitis, as you've just mentioned, but it did show findings of acute transverse myelitis.
All right. Acute transverse myelitis. Now, that's something that we don't see every day. Let's just start with, what is acute transverse myelitis?
So acute transverse myelitis is a relatively rare inflammatory demyelinating disorder of the spinal cord. The highest incidence of the condition occurs between 10 and 20 years of age and 30 and 40 years of age, with about 20% of cases occurring in the pediatric population, so people under 18 years of age. Idiopathic transverse myelitis is thought to occur as a post-infectious phenomenon, likely due to some kind of autoimmune process. But transverse myelitis can also be a secondary process. So it can be associated with active infections. Virtually every type of infection has been reported to be associated with transverse myelitis, including EBV or mono, as well as many other common viruses like enteroviruses that we see all summer long. It can be associated with systemic inflammatory conditions, so things like lupus and other connective tissue disorders. And it can be part of a larger multifocal central nervous system condition or demyelinating disorder like MS, multiple sclerosis, or something we see more common in pediatrics, something called ADEM, which is an acronym for acute disseminated encephalomyelitis. So again, transverse myelitis can be part of a larger CNS disease.
All right, so that's what transverse myelitis is. How does it present differently to, say, a spinal epidural abscess, which is going to be what we're most worried about? Because my understanding is transverse myelitis, you want to get the diagnosis in the emergency department, but it's not quite as emergent a diagnosis to make. In fact, my understanding is that transverse myelitis is often missed on the first and second visits, and then eventually it's diagnosed, and that the treatment isn't quite, again, as emergent as something like a spinal epidural abscess where the patient can go paraplegic within hours. So how does it present typically, and how is it different than, say, a spinal epidural abscess or discitis or osteomyelitis of the vertebra?
Sure. So transverse myelitis can develop very quickly. You mentioned sort of a slower progression, and that may be the case sometimes, but it can progress either pretty acutely or subacutely. So meaning over hours and sometimes over a few days.
Interesting. So that's something that I'm learning new. I always thought that transverse myelitis was something that presents quite slowly. Okay. So it can present just over a few hours.
Yep. It can present definitely over like a 12 to 24 hour period where symptoms sort of become more obvious, similar to things like an epidural abscess. But it can, there are reports of it taking up to sort of a couple of weeks. I think that's probably not the norm. We're probably thinking more of the time, mostly hours to 1 or 2 days. But you're not wrong in that often it is missed on first presentation and patients will come back within 24 to 48 hours with progressive symptoms. So as the name implies, transverse, it typically or classically affects the entire transverse section of the spinal cord at a certain level or multiple associated levels. And it causes motor, sensory, and or autonomic dysfunction below the level of the lesion. So from a motor perspective, we generally talk about a relatively rapidly progressive either paraparesis or paraplegia, depending on the level of the lesion. So for example, if it's thoracic versus if it's higher up, you may actually have quadriparesis or quadriplegia. From a sensory point of view, most patients with transverse myelitis have a sensory level or like a dermatomal level at which sensation is normal above and reduced or absent below. And really, really important to remember that sensory symptoms can also include pain. So specifically back pain or dysesthesias. So that's a really important thing to remember because it can be an important initial presenting symptom in up to 60% of cases of transverse myelitis. And then finally, the third component of nervous system involvement is the autonomic symptoms, which classically involves bowel and bladder function, and that includes both incontinence or retention. And again, important to remember, urinary retention may be the first sign of myelitis, and that's why it should always warrant further investigation. So just to sort of, again, summarize from a transverse myelitis point of view, symptoms that should cause a clinician to consider acute transverse myelitis include weakness and sensory loss in a myelopathic distribution accompanied by bowel or bladder incontinence or urinary retention.
All right, yeah, let's get more into urinary retention. So this is a case of neurogenic urinary retention. Let's get deeper into pediatric urinary retention in general and go through the differential. Let's say you have like a four-year-old. They're not typically going to volunteer that they can't pee. So let's just start with the history. Like, how do you discover that a child, especially the young children, have urinary retention? Like that, how do you actually ask them about their urinary symptoms?
So like many other things in pediatrics, a lot of the information you obtain is going to be from the caregivers and not necessarily patients themselves. That obviously will be different the older the child is and if you have an adolescent patient. But caregivers may come in and report that their child is just not peeing or haven't peed in X amount of hours. So in that case, the first thing is it's important to sort of discern whether this is because they have no urine or there's actual oliguria, whether that be from dehydration or renal pathology versus like they actually have urine and they're just sort of not letting it out for whatever reason.
Yeah, that's an interesting, I mean, we see that all the time. You know, we're asking about urine output in the last 24 hours, how many wet diapers.
But it's a good cognitive forcing strategy to think, you know, it's not just that we're asking about dehydration and, you know, volume, that we should think in the back of our minds, oh, could this be like a neurogenic bladder, or could this be some other cause of urinary retention? So I think that's just a great little cognitive forcing strategy there that we can use when parents tell you, oh, they're not peeing, or they've only wet their diaper once in the last 24 hours. Don't immediately always assume that it's because of dehydration.
Great point, and very true. Other things to just keep in mind, caregivers sometimes will report that their children, or they have a feeling that the child is holding their pee or can't fully empty their bladder. And sometimes they report like frequent trips to the bathroom and maybe with very, very little urine output, like only dribbling or weak streams. Young patients or even adolescents sometimes, in the example I gave, who maybe are not as articulate or eloquent, may use like a whole host of nondescript sensations. Like, it just feels weird when I try and go to the bathroom. And then, of course, it can present with significant abdominal pain, abdominal or bladder distension, or just sometimes even just like restlessness or irritability in younger patients. So in adults, acute urinary retention is defined as an inability to void voluntarily despite a full bladder. Children often cannot articulate, you know, the sensation of bladder fullness or an inability to void. So how do we assess this in kids? Urinary retention is generally in pediatrics defined as an inability to void for at least 12 hours or no urine output for 12 hours with a volume of urine greater than expected for age in their bladder, or with a palpably distended bladder. And if you're wondering to yourself, well, I don't know, how much is how much urine does a kid have in their bladder, or should they have in their bladder? There's a pretty quick formula to help us figure this out that you can use sort of as a tool. So in ounces, it's a very straightforward formula. For children under 12 years of age, it's just age plus 2, and that gets you sort of the number of ounces. Just a reminder, there's 30 cc's per ounce. So you would multiply that number by 30 to get the total number in cc's. So I'll give you an example. If you have a 5-year-old patient, you would say 5 plus 2 is 7. That's 7 ounces. And if you want to know that in milliliters, 7 times 30 is 210. So you'd use approximately 210 ml would be sort of the max bladder capacity or max amount or fluid volume or urine volume you would expect in the bladder in an otherwise healthy 5-year-old.
Fantastic. So a quick bladder scan can really be helpful. And normal urine volume cutoff is age plus 2 times 30. We'll have that in the show notes for people who want a quick reference for that when they're on shift. Okay, so now we suspect urinary retention. How do you go about sorting out through the differential?
So acute urinary retention is a really great example of the old mantra, like kids or not, little adults. So urinary retention, you'd know better than me, probably relatively frequent in the adult population in terms of presentations to the emergency department.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the large majority of cases are ultimately linked to the prostate and things like benign prostatic hyperplasia and other prostate pathology.
Correct, Aruni.
Okay, perfect. So I'll tell you straight off the bat, you're never going to see urinary retention secondary to prostate pathology in a pediatric patient. So take it off your differential right away. So pediatric urinary retention is a much rarer complaint in pediatrics. It's not something you're going to see on a daily basis. And the differential is pretty heterogeneous. There's lots of different things that can cause it. So the first major category, and you can probably group these two things together, are infectious and inflammatory. And probably these are like the leading causes of urinary retention that we see. So when we talk about infectious, it's no surprise, urinary tract infections, cystitis. And then from an inflammatory standpoint, we're really thinking about, in boys, balanitis or balanoposthitis, and much more rarely, but other causes of like local irritation in females like vulvovaginitis, which can lead to sort of withholding of urine. So that would be the first category. The second category is what I call obstructive. So this occurs when urine flow is physically blocked, and obstruction can also occur at various levels. And probably the most common level is urethral obstruction. And this includes things that you can see just on basic physical exam. So the classic examples of this would be phimosis, or a very tight or obstructing foreskin, to meatal stenosis in boys, and then more rarely labial adhesions in girls. To those things you can't see on your physical exam, like things like urethral strictures or a phenomenon in pediatrics called posterior urethral valves. So the other main category in the obstructive bucket, so to speak, is external compression of the bladder leading to obstruction. And typically you can't make this diagnosis without other studies, imaging studies, I should say, like ultrasounds or sometimes other advanced scans. And this includes really anything intra-abdominal or pelvic or any type of intra-abdominal or pelvic mass or tumor of any kind. So we see sacrococcygeal teratomas, neuroblastomas present this way. And I'll throw this one in because I've now seen it twice present in pubertal age girls with acute urinary retention, is something called hematometricolpos, which I'm not sure you're familiar with.
Wow, never heard of that one.
Yeah, it's a mouthful. But it's basically essentially refers to blood accumulation in the vagina and uterus. And there's basically massive distension of those organs due to either an imperforate hymen or a transverse vaginal septum. So again, this is like a pubertal age girl who is now starting menses, but there's no exit route for the blood. So it accumulates and creates this sort of massive mass in the belly, which then presses on the bladder.
I actually have heard of that. I just didn't know the name of it. What was the name again?
Hematometricolpos.
Got it. Okay. So just to review there a little bit, we've got sort of the post-op stuff and anesthesia related stuff that causes urinary retention, which we're not going to see much of in the eMERGE. There's infectious, probably the most common, I would think, just cystitis. And then all these obstructive causes. And the obstructive can be anything, just go through all the anatomy from outside in, essentially, to think about the obstructive. Okay. Anything else we're missing in terms of urinary retention? I mean, there's behavioral, I would think.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, there's that. And
that's fairly common as well, I would think. Yeah.
It is. I'll talk to you about that. So dysfunctional uterine voiding is what we call it in pediatrics. And it really refers to a condition where a child has difficulty fully emptying their bladder. And it is often due to behavioral patterns of holding in urine, but it can also be due to lack of coordination between bladder muscles and urethral sphincter muscles, leading to incomplete bladder emptying. This is, of course, not something you're going to diagnose in the emergency department. It's more or less ends up being a diagnosis of exclusion. And typically these kids are referred to specialists like urologists who do more advanced studies like voiding cystourethrograms and other types of urodynamic studies. I'll sort of throw in a couple other things here. I do want to make sure we just circle back to sort of the category not to miss, which is the neurogenic category. And we did start to talk about it, but there's other things in that bucket that always need to be considered. So bladder dysfunction due to neurogenic causes can occur at any level. So from the brain to the spinal cord to the peripheral nerves. The most relevant in the pediatric population is really spinal cord related, and the pathology there could either be compressive or inflammatory. So when we talk about compressive, so it's things like spinal tumors, so things like ependymomas, astrocytomas are the most common spinal tumors that you'll see in like the pediatric population. But compression can also come from other things. You already mentioned, you know, epidural abscesses. There's sometimes rarely like herniated discs or hematomas from trauma can also do it. And then inflammatory conditions, we've already talked about sort of the main one, which is acute transverse myelitis. Also probably worth throwing in GBS or Guillain-Barré, which is like transverse myelitis, another example of an acute inflammatory demyelinating condition, but it's a polyneuropathy of the peripheral nervous system as opposed to a myelopathy that affects the spine. But it can present somewhat similarly and mimic transverse myelitis. And yet another plug for completing a thorough neuro exam with attention to reflexes. And one last thing I'll mention in babies or younger kids who present with urinary retention, always important to do a really good back exam. You want to make pay particular attention to the presence of things like sacral dimples or sacral tufts of hair, which can be a sign of spinal cord malformations like spina bifida or tethered cord, which can also cause urinary retention.
All right, fantastic. So our differential to summarize there, at the top of the list should be neurogenic urinary retention. And within this, you want to think obstructive versus inflammatory. like in our case, transverse myelitis. Then there's mechanical obstruction from, say, phimosis or urethral strictures or pelvic tumors. And then there's infections like UTI, balanitis. I guess severe constipation can cause it, and that might not be so uncommon as well. And finally, there's this, they call it pediatric voiding dysfunction, which is usually behavioral, which is kind of a diagnosis of exclusion.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'll just make another plug and mention of constipation, because as you just said, not at all an uncommon cause of urinary retention in pediatrics. So I think constipation and lower urinary tract symptoms often coexist. I think a lot of people think about enuresis and incontinence when I think about constipation, but actually constipation can cause urinary retention as well. It's thought that, you know, a large buildup of stool in the rectum can physically press on the bladder and lead to obstruction. But there's also evidence that it can cause reflex inhibition of bladder detrusor contraction and increased urethral sphincter tone.
Well, that's one diagnosis where kids are just like little adults.
That's funny.
Because, yeah, we do see that not infrequently in adults is just severe constipation causing urinary retention for sure.
Oh, wow.
Often we'll, you know, do a Fleet enema, relieve the constipation, and then suddenly their urinary retention is miraculously cured.
Okay, wow. So yes, definitely some similarities there. And then, and maybe one other way that adults and kids may be similar in that drugs may play a role in urinary retention as well. However, probably the prime focus and main culprits may be a little bit different. So I would imagine maybe in your population, you would see things like opioids as like the primary culprits for things like this. We don't see a lot of kids who are on sort of high dose opioids, but things like anticholinergics, like specifically like antihistamines, which are commonly used in the pediatric populations, and sympathomimetics, which are often an ingredient in decongestants, like cough and cold like medicines, can also play a role. So you always want to ask about medication exposures as well.
Right. Which in little kids, we should never be giving cough and cold medicines anyhow because they're associated with death.
Amazing. Yeah. Good that you know that.
Good. All right. Dr. Schoenfeld, any other tips, tricks, pearls, pitfalls when it comes to pediatric urinary retention? We've covered some great stuff here. It's a really kind of interesting topic in that there's like a really great differential to go through. Any other tips or tricks we're missing?
Yeah, I'll share some final thoughts with you. So the first is that just like a small pearl that I find is helpful for people who don't often deal with children, that pediatric urinary retention due specifically to pain from local inflammation or infection. So specifically things like balanitis or urethritis or UTI, you know, can typically be managed with oral pain meds. And the important piece is the soaking in warm water and specifically letting patients urinate in that environment. So this decreases direct contact of acidic urine with inflamed or irritated tissue on the glands or the urethra and reduces withholding behaviors. So you just, you know, sort of tell that toddler who has like really bad balanitis and they're not peeing because it burns when they pee, just put them in that bathtub and just let them pee in that bathtub. They'll have zero pain that way.
And important to tell that toddler that the same rule does not apply when they go to the public swimming pool.
Yes, that's fair. That's fair. It might create some confusion. The second is that I mentioned already that UTI is a leading cause of acute urinary retention. So you always want to check a urine in the ED. But my caveat here would be don't be too quick to diagnose a UTI or pyelonephritis and overlook other potentially ominous signs and symptoms. The next would be that unexplained urinary retention, especially in a previously healthy adolescent, is always a concerning sign or symptom. You always want to consider a neurologic or spinal pathology if basic tests like a urine test or a urine dip and an abdominal ultrasound are negative. Do not send a child home with a Foley and a leg bag that you may do for an older gentleman with prostate problems. I have seen a number of cases like this. Never ends well and almost always ends up being a neurogenic etiology for the urinary retention.
What a fantastic pitfall to leave our listeners with. All right. Well, thanks so much, Deb. That was fantastic. I hope we can have you on again and maybe even have you speak at the EM Cases Summit in November 2026.
Love to join you there.
You're seeing a patient who presents with ischemic chest pain but is STEMI negative. what is the likelihood this patient has an acute coronary occlusion? According to the current STEMI paradigm, the answer should be zero, because acute coronary occlusion is defined by STEMI criteria. If there's no ST elevation on the ECG, there should be no acute coronary occlusion in the patient. No matter how high the peak troponin, no matter how bad the resulting heart failure, if the ECG is STEMI negative, then it's by definition a non-STEMI treated non-urgently. But that doesn't make any sense. No other disease is defined and treated based on one part of one test, like the ST segment on the ECG. This would be like defining appendicitis by the white blood cell count, and dichotomizing into leukocytotic appendicitis that gets same-day CT versus non-leukocytotic appendicitis that gets a CT in the next day or two. We've all seen appendicitis with a normal white blood cell count, and we know that this one test does not rule out this disease. Every test merely modifies the probability of disease. We first need to determine the patient's pretest likelihood based on history and physical. We then apply each test, knowing its diagnostic benefits and limitations, to determine post-test likelihood and guide further management. For the disease of appendicitis, the white blood cell count has a positive likelihood ratio of about 3 and a negative likelihood ratio of about 0.3, both of which are only moderate. So a patient with non-specific abdominal pain and an elevated white blood cell count still has a low likelihood of appendicitis. Conversely, a patient with migratory right lower quadrant pain and McBurney point tenderness but a normal white blood cell count still has a high likelihood of appendicitis and requires imaging. So how does the test of STEMI criteria help us to diagnose the disease of occlusion MI? According to the latest evidence, STEMI criteria has a positive likelihood ratio of 12.5, which is much better than the white blood cell count for appendicitis. So for a patient with acute shortness of breath, which may be an angina equivalent, the presence of STEMI criteria greatly increases their likelihood of occlusion MI, so they need cath lab activation even if they don't have classic chest pain. But the negative likelihood ratio of STEMI criteria is only 0.59, which is worse than the white blood cell count for appendicitis. For a patient with acute ischemic chest pain, the absence of STEMI criteria does very little to lower their likelihood of occlusion MI. So how can we optimize our diagnosis of occlusion MI? First, we need to determine the patient's pretest likelihood by thinking of ACS. A is for all anginal equivalents, not just chest pain. C is for continuous versus resolved symptoms. And S is for stability versus instability. A patient with continuous anginal symptoms and hemodynamic instability has a high pretest likelihood of OMI, which influences the interpretation of tests. Second, we need to optimize ECG interpretation. As the American College of Cardiologists expert consensus reminds us, application of STEMI ECG criteria will miss a significant minority of patients who have acute coronary occlusion. In other words, the test is not the same as the disease, and we need to increase the utility of the test. The positive likelihood ratio of advanced ECG signs for the disease of OMI is 14, and the negative likelihood ratio is 0.23, both of which are far better than STEMI criteria. So modified Scarboza criteria significantly raises the likelihood of OMI in left bundle branch block, while lack of reciprocal change in AVL significantly lowers the likelihood of OMI when there's borderline inferior ST elevation. But notice that the negative likelihood ratio of OMI on ECG is not zero. Patients can have an acute coronary occlusion without any ECG changes, which is why OMI is not defined by the ECG or by any one test for that matter. Third, we can add point-of-care ultrasound to look for regional wall motion abnormalities, especially if patients have a high pretest likelihood but subtle ECG changes. In a patient with refractory ischemic chest pain, acute CHF, and a new regional wall motion abnormality on POCUS, their pretest likelihood for OMI is so high that the ECG ceases to matter because they need an angiogram. This is like the post-op patient with sudden pleuritic chest pain, hemoptysis, and hypoxia, where you don't care about the D-dimer because they're so high likely that they need a CT. So clinical assessment, ECG interpretation, and point-of-care ultrasound, they operate like a triptych, those three-paneled paintings that tell a story. The first panel provides the pretest likelihood, the second the ECG, and the third point-of-care ultrasound. OMI is not based on any one panel, but the story they collectively tell. Sometimes the story is obvious, with classic chest pain and tombstone ST elevation, but sometimes it's more complex, with anginal equivalents, subtle ECG signs, and corresponding regional wall motion abnormalities. The OMI paradigm shift not only enhances the capabilities of ECG interpretation, but also puts the ECG in context as one of many tests to be applied clinically, to answer the real question that matters. Not does the ECG meet same criteria, but does the patient have an acute coronary occlusion? For multiple cases on the art of OMI, using the triptych of clinical ECG and POCUS, visit the ECG Cases blog on EM Cases. And for live and interactive courses to elevate your ECG skills, visit heartsecgcourse.com.
And now a message from one of our sponsors. Are you an emergency physician looking for an exciting opportunity? Cornwall Hospital is hiring motivated ER docs to join their dynamic team. With over 50,000 visits a year, you'll see a wide variety of pathologies in a fast-paced, supportive environment. Your colleagues and consultants are always ready and willing to back you up. Cornwall, Ontario is a hidden gem on the St. Lawrence River, offering waterfront access, outdoor activities, and a small city charm, all within an hour's drive from Ottawa and Montreal. Join their family at Cornwall Community Hospital, and once you're there, you'll never look back. For more information, please visit www.cornwallhospital.ca and click on Join Our Team, Physician Recruitment, or call 613-938-4240, extension 2227. Every year or two, I see a patient who returns to the ED after they've had an LP at the previous visit with a headache. And at the top of the differential is postdural puncture headache. I know a little bit about why these happen and that it's treated with caffeine and a dural patch, but that's about all. So Matthew MacArthur is going to enlighten us about the latest on managing postdural puncture headache. Take it away, Matthew.
A 40-year-old female presents to your emergency department with a chief complaint of headache. She was actually seen in your ED yesterday complaining of a headache and underwent a lumbar puncture as part of her workup. The lumbar puncture and remainder of ED workup was unremarkable, and she was ultimately sent home with modest improvements in her symptoms after receiving NSAIDs and metoclopramide. Now she's back today, and she looks miserable. She says the headache is way worse, and it's different than what she had when she first came in. It now has a positional quality. It is relieved somewhat when she lies down, but when she sits or stands up, she gets an intolerable, pounding headache with associated neck and shoulder stiffness, tinnitus, diplopia, and dizziness. Based on a new positional headache after recent lumbar puncture, you astutely recognize this to be a case of postdural puncture headache. In this quick hit, I will review what you need to know about this common complication of dural puncture. There's a recent consensus guideline on the topic published in 2023 in JAMA Open, which is a great reference that I will include in the show notes along with a few other references. Postdural puncture headache is very common and probably underreported, with estimates ranging from 2 to 40% depending on procedural and patient factors. The presentation can range from mild symptoms to severe and disabling symptoms. Postdural puncture headache is caused by low CSF due to ongoing CSF leak. Multiple pathophysiology mechanisms have been proposed, including compensatory venodilation of the meninges and mechanical sagging of the brain, nerves, and meninges due to low CSF volume. The diagnosis should be suspected in any patient with a new positional headache that occurs within 5 days of a dural puncture, for example, from diagnostic LP, spinal anesthesia, or accidental dural puncture during epidural anesthesia. The headache is almost always worse in the upright position and relieved by lying flat. Common associated symptoms include neck and shoulder pain, tinnitus, visual disturbances, and vertigo. If untreated, symptoms typically resolve within 1 week, as this is how long it usually takes for the punctured dura to heal. There are two main patient factors that increase risk of developing headache after dural puncture. The main patient factor is age. Independent of procedural factors, young adults are more likely to get this complication, and the risk decreases with increasing age. Females are also more likely than males. A plausible hypothesis to explain this is that younger and female adults have more elastic meningeal structures, whereas in older adults, the meninges are more stiff and therefore less prone to ongoing leaking and sagging. Procedural factors are also a pivotal risk factor for who will go on to develop postdural puncture headache. The main procedural factors are size and type of spinal needle. These procedural factors are pretty intuitive. A bigger needle will make a bigger hole and a bigger CSF leak. Try to use a 25 gauge or smaller, if possible, to decrease risk of postdural puncture headache. But needle type is also critical here. Most needles we're used to using in the emergency department have a sharp cutting bevel that slices through tissues. However, slicing through the dural fibers is a really bad idea when it comes to creating a hole for CSF leak. For this reason, non-cutting spinal needles, which have a conical or pencil tip, were developed. These needles spread apart the dural fibers in a comparatively atraumatic fashion and have been shown to massively decrease the risk of postdural puncture headache. Prevention is the best cure. The 2023 consensus guidelines recommend routine use of non-cutting spinal needles for lumbar puncture for all populations based on grade A evidence with a high level of certainty. Many emergency departments still do not routinely stock non-cutting spinal needles, even though they're readily available and first choice in the ORs. This is an easy change to make at a departmental level to provide the best care for our patients. If for any reason you're unsuccessful with the non-cutting needle, there's no harm to switching to the cutting needle. If you do have to use a cutting needle for whatever reason, use the narrowest gauge possible and position the needle with bevel aligned in the longitudinal axis of the spine so that you slice through the dura parallel to the dural fibers. Okay, so now we've covered clinical presentation and risk factors. Do any of these patients need imaging? No, not routinely. According to the guidelines, you should get neuroimaging if there are focal neurologic deficits, vision changes, altered GCS, or seizures. Additionally, if you suspect a different diagnosis, for instance, if your patient has a non-positional headache or a headache more than 5 days after the dural puncture, imaging may be warranted. So now that we covered clinical presentation, risk factors, and evaluation, what is the treatment for postdural puncture headache? The treatment modalities include non-pharmacologic, pharmacologic, and procedural. As far as non-pharmacologic, keeping the patient supine with bed rest won't do anything to make them get better faster, but it may help them stay more comfortable. Maintaining adequate hydration is important, and this should be done with oral hydration whenever possible. As far as pharmacologic measures, start with NSAIDs and Tylenol, which may provide symptomatic relief. A short course of opioids could be added if this initial treatment is inadequate. Additionally, for patients presenting within 24 hours of symptom onset, there's some low-quality evidence for caffeine up to 900 milligrams per day for symptom relief. Patients with more severe symptoms that do not respond to these conservative measures may require procedural intervention. The definitive management is an epidural blood patch. In this procedure, an anesthesiologist injects 20 milliliters of the patient's own blood into the epidural space at the level of the dural puncture. The blood will spread through the epidural space and form a clot, which patches up the leaky hole in the dura, fixing the problem. I don't know about you, but I think that's a pretty creative solution to this problem. Other procedural options include local anesthetic nerve blocks for symptom relief. I've already reviewed the technique for occipital nerve block in Quick Hits episode 65, and in summary, it's a quick and easy local anesthetic injection at the back of the head that can be effective for headache. It turns out that there's some research into using occipital nerve block for postdural puncture headache, and there's moderate quality evidence that it's effective at providing symptom relief. Another local anesthetic technique that has been studied here is the transnasal sphenopalatine block, which is a very safe and easy topical anesthetic block. No injections required. A few different approaches to getting the topical anesthetic into the right place have been described, but a commonly taught approach involves putting concentrated lidocaine, typically 2 to 5%, onto two cotton swabs and advancing the swabs down both nostrils until contact is made with the posterior pharynx. The swabs are left in place for 10 to 15 minutes to allow time for the topical anesthetic to absorb into the tissues. The evidence for this in postdural puncture headache is pretty mixed, but it's quick and safe, so I see very little downside to trying it. There's also some literature for the topical sphenopalatine block in other headaches like migraines, so I would really encourage you to consider adding it to your toolkit. The main issue is, neither of these local anesthetic techniques do anything to fix the leaking hole in the patient's dura, they just temporarily mask the symptoms. So once the local anesthetic wears off in a few hours, the patient is very likely to have rebound headaches. For this reason, I would definitely use a longer-acting anesthetic like bupivacaine rather than lidocaine, if possible. Alright, so here's your summary of today's quick hit. Postural puncture headache is a positional headache that improves when supine and worsens when upright, that usually occurs within 5 days of a dural puncture, and it's caused by leakage of CSF out of the hole in the dura. Patient risk factors include younger age and female sex, and procedural risk factors include dural puncture with cutting needles and larger bore needles. The best treatment is prevention, and if your ED does not stock non-cutting spinal needles, which have a pencil tip rather than a sharp bevel, you should really talk with your department about getting them. Imaging is not required as long as there are no focal neurologic symptoms, changes in GCS, vision changes, or if you suspect a different diagnosis based on history and exam. Conservative treatment includes oral hydration, multimodal analgesia with NSAIDs and Tylenol, plus or minus opioids and caffeine. Definitive management for severe and refractory symptoms is an epidural blood patch performed by anesthesia to fix the dural leak. Other treatment options include local anesthetic nerve blocks for headache, specifically the occipital nerve block or the topical sphenopalatine block. Unfortunately, these only provide temporary relief, and the headache will most likely come back after the anesthetic wears off. But there's little downside to performing these quick and easy blocks to potentially spare your patients a much more invasive blood patch procedure, or as a bridge to alleviate their symptoms while awaiting definitive management.
Let's take a little break to hear from one of our sponsors, Metricade, the experts in complex physician scheduling since 2012. Metricade's expert schedulers are their secret sauce. These people truly understand the complexities of physician scheduling. They empower us by providing the tools we need to manage our teams efficiently. At the same time, they give physicians more freedom to share their workflow preferences, so schedules aren't just fair, they're actually workable. Metricade's system is built to make your schedule work for you. They take the stress out of shift planning so that you can focus on what matters most. Go to metricade.com/emcases to learn more about how smarter scheduling can work for you. That's metricade, one word, .com/emcases. All right, today we're launching a brand new series on the podcast that I think is going to be really valuable to anyone who practices emergency medicine or urgent care. This is going to be called MedMal Cases. And in this series, we're going to get right into the nitty-gritty of cases that went sideways. And we're not here to point fingers, but really just to put these cases under the microscope to figure out the cognitive traps, the system errors, and ultimately to learn how to avoid these pitfalls in our own practice. And to help us navigate this, I'm pleased to have on the show for the first time, Dr. Joseph Yasmeh. Joe is an urgent care physician in Los Angeles, and he has a real passion for this stuff, risk management, medical decision-making. Thanks for being on the show, Joe. Welcome to EM Cases.
Thanks for having me, Anton. I'm excited to get into it. Long-time fan of the show. These are cases that really push us to be better, and I think it's a vital conversation to have.
Absolutely. And the case that we're going to start with today is sort of a classic. It's a wolf in a sheep's clothing, so to speak. It looks like one of those benign things that you'll see, you know, a young guy with a tiny cut on his hand. When I say that, I'm sure some of the audience will already guess what this is going to be about. We're going to talk about why the story the patient gives you may not be exactly true and might not exactly reflect what happened accurately, and how assuming that the patient always tells the truth can trip us up sometimes and set in motion this chain of events that could end up in bad outcomes.
That's exactly right, Anton. The anatomy of the hand is so unforgiving, but for this specific injury, it's really about the art of being a good detective. It's about spotting the disconnect, the chasm between the story the patient's telling you and the story the wound is telling you. And learning to trust the wound is one of the most critical skills you can have.
Now, before we dive into the details of the case, I have to give a special thank you to Dr. Michael Weinstock. The case is drawn from his book, Bounce Backs, for anyone out there who wants to learn more about med mal cases. It's a great book.
I don't receive any funds from Mike or from the Bounce Backs book. All right, you're on duty on a typical late morning around 11 a.m. The patient's an 18-year-old male, left-handed, who hurts his hand the night before. And he says he was, quote, messing around with some friends near an old brick wall. A brick got loose and it fell directly onto the back of his left hand.
Yeah, the messing around story, minding his own business, and a falling brick. Right off the bat, the story has problems. You got to think about the physics. Falling brick is a blunt object. It will leave a crushing, contused, sprawling injury. The odds of it landing perfectly edge-on with the right amount of force to create a neat 1 centimeter cut over a single knuckle without causing a fracture or a much larger bruise, it's incredibly unlikely. The story just doesn't fit the injury pattern.
Yeah, it really doesn't. So the physician goes to see him. And just as you said, it's a small, sort of tidy-looking 1 centimeter laceration right over the knuckle of his middle finger, the third MCP joint. The hand is swollen, it's a bit red, and he says it hurts to move the finger. Now, during the exam, the doctor immobilizes the hand and gently tries to move the patient's finger for him. So this is passive range of motion. And here it is, the line in the chart, quote, "Even passive range of motion of the third MCP causes pain with both flexion and extension." All right, Joe, so what are you thinking at this point?
My mind goes to one place and one place only. It's the clenched fist injury, or what we colloquially call a fight bite. And the patient is actively misleading us. The story about the brick isn't just unlikely, it's a cover story. An 18-year-old male with a laceration over a dominant hand knuckle is the absolute textbook presentation. And the cardinal rule is any laceration over the dorsal aspect of an MCP or PIP joint, particularly of dominant hand, must be considered a clenched fist injury until proven otherwise.
All right, could you tell us a little bit more about the mechanism and how this becomes a horrible, terrible outcome in a lot of patients if it's not recognized early and treated early?
Yeah, because the mechanism completely changes the entire risk profile of the injury. A brick falling on the hand is a crush injury. A fist hitting the tooth is an inoculation injury. You got to think about what happens. The patient makes a fist, and at the moment of impact, the skin and the extensor tendon are stretched taut over that knuckle. The opponent's tooth acts like a sharp, contaminated spear. And that spear easily penetrates those thin layers and drives a polymicrobial cocktail of human oral flora, nasty stuff, deep into the hand. And it frequently violates the joint capsule itself. But here's the really insidious part. The anatomical trap that makes this injury so dangerous. The moment the hand relaxes and the fingers extend, everything shifts. So the hole in the skin and the hole in the tendon both retract backwards, away from the deeper stationary tear in the joint capsule. And this action effectively seals the bacteria inside the joint, hiding the true depth of the injury under now what looks like a simple superficial cut. It transformed the puncture wound into this deep sealed inoculation with the synovial fluid inside the joint serving as a rich culture medium for an aggressive infection.
That's a great explanation for the pathophysiology of this apparently benign thing that actually turns out to be pretty nasty. All right, Joe, so we have a situation where the physical exam is suggestive of a deep infection, even if the patient's story is trying to throw us off. The treating physician moves on to the workup and management. First, they get an x-ray of the hand. Of course, we want to rule out a foreign body. We want to rule out a fracture. The official read comes back and it says negative for fracture or foreign body. So Joe, does this negative x-ray lower your concern at all?
No, not really. It's a necessary test, but it's dangerously reassuring if you don't know what you're looking for. You get the x-ray just exactly like you said, rule out a fracture of the metacarpal head, which happens a lot with these injuries. And you're looking for more subtle signs, like maybe a tiny tooth fragment that might have broken off in the wound, gas in the soft tissues, or a little pocket of air in the joint space, which would be a giveaway that the joint capsule has been breached. But a negative x-ray tells you nothing about the most important part of the injury, damage to the tendons, the ligaments, the joint capsule. And it doesn't rule out the presence of a brewing infection. So I'm still just as worried as I was before the film was taken.
All right, so x-ray's done, but we're not reassured. The next step documented is the wound care. And the note says the wound was anesthetized, irrigated, and explored. Excellent. And during that exploration, they note that, quote, "the extensor tendon was intact, but the tendon sheath was frayed," unquote. Then they close the wound with two loose 4.0 Ethylon sutures. Let's talk about this part a little bit more. So the exploration and the closure. What do you think was done right and what do you think was not done right here?
Yeah. So this is where the case really takes a sharp turn towards disaster. So first, the finding of a frayed tendon sheath. It's something you want to look for, but it's not a minor detail they just document and move on from. So it's a direct sign of significant injury. The sheath is supposed to be smooth, pristine in the tunnel. Frayed means it was violated. That's your proof the injury is deep. But the truly critical error, Anton, was closing the wound. This might be the single most dangerous thing you could do for this injury. You have a deep wound that you know, or might be highly suspicious, is contaminated with aggressive oral bacteria. And putting sutures in it is just like locking a fox in a hen house. You've just created a perfect, warm, anaerobic, closed space environment for an abscess to form. You seal the infection in right on top of the tendon and the joint. And the general consensus is that a fight bite must be left open to drain.
Agreed. So after closing the wound, they move on to antibiotics. The patient's given 1 gram of Ancef or cefazolin IM and then handed a prescription for cefalexin. What are your thoughts on the antibiotic selection of choice here?
Yeah, it's inadequate. So it's the second critical error. Ancef, Cephalex, they're first generation cephalosporins. They're excellent for simple skin infections caused by staph and strep. But a human bite isn't a simple cellulitis. It's a different beast. You have no coverage for the weird, fastidious gram-negative rods that live in the mouth. The classic pathogen we worry about, and the one that was eventually cultured in this case, is Eichinella, which is notoriously resistant to first-generation cephalosporins. It's also often resistant to Clinda, metronidazole, but not Bactrim, TMPSMX. On top of that, you have to think about the wound type. A bite is this deep puncture that injects bacteria into a closed space. It's this perfect oxygen-free environment for anaerobic bacteria to thrive. Keflex doesn't really cover anaerobes that well, so you're missing a whole other class of dangerous bugs. Also, why tetanus coverage is so critical. A fight rarely happens in a sterile environment. Maybe the hand hits the ground or a wall and is contaminated with dirt. You always have to assume that risk and make sure that tetanus is up to date. So overall, by treating this fight bite as a simple cellulitis, you essentially give the most dangerous bacteria a free pass to multiply.
So the antibiotic of choice is going to be amoxicillin clavulanate, which in the US, I believe, is called Augmentin, and in Canada, it's called Clavulin. All right, so we have a questionable closure, and the antibiotic of choice is probably not the right one. Let's talk about the last step, and that's disposition. So the patient was discharged home with a splint and told to follow up with the plastic surgeon, quote, in a couple of days, unquote.
Yeah, and that's critical error number three. And that's what sealed the patient's fate in this case. So the infection doesn't wait for a follow-up appointment. It's a freight train of tissue destruction. The standard of care is reevaluation within 24 hours. Telling the patient to follow up in a couple of days underestimates the speed at which this disease can cause irreversible damage. Over a weekend, the infection could destroy the cartilage in the joint, knead through the tendon. And there's no coming back from that. Patient should have been given strict instructions to be seen the very next day, either back in the ED or by a hand specialist who's already been notified. Discharging the patient with a multi-day follow-up plan was unfortunately negligent in this case.
Okay, so the patient was sent home with a sutured contaminated wound, with not the ideal antibiotic, with a longer follow-up than you'd want, usually 24 hours, these patients should be seen. And just as you predicted, things went downhill pretty fast. So the very next day, the patient calls the ED. The note says he's complaining that the swelling and pain in his hand is already worse. And then he reveals a critical piece of information that he hasn't been taking the antibiotics because he can't afford the prescription. He was advised to return to the ED, but he doesn't. A few days go by. Then at 1 o'clock in the morning, he finally comes back. This time the chart paints a very different picture. He's described as looking very uncomfortable, holding his hand above his head, and his face is grimacing from pain. He's got a new story now, saying his girlfriend accidentally kicked his hand and it felt that the wound opened up. And when the physician examines him, there's a small amount of frank, purulent drainage oozing from between the sutures.
And there it is. It's the inevitable bounce back. This is the natural history of a mismanaged clenched fist injury playing out exactly as textbooks would describe. The new story about the girlfriend is just another layer of misdirection, but at this point, the story doesn't even matter. The hand's declaring its own truth.
So on the second visit, the management is what you'd expect for such a severe infection. They give him a big dose of ampicillin-celbactam. They give him IV pain medication, get a wound culture, and immediately consult the plastic surgeon on call, who admits the patient to the hospital for surgery the next morning. I just want to go back to that phone call. So the patient says he can't afford the prescription. This is a common real-world problem. How much does that sort of factor into our risk management and our responsibility as clinicians?
It's a massive factor. It's a huge part of this case's lesson. A brilliant diagnosis, perfect treatment plan are worthless if the patient can't access the treatment. So it's where our job extends beyond just writing the prescription. There are a couple concrete things we can and should do. First, give the first dose of the antibiotic in the ED before the patient leaves. The patient actually did give a shot of Ancef, which was a good idea in principle, even if it wasn't the ideal antibiotic. Giving the first dose of the correct antibiotic, like oral Augmentin, starts the treatment immediately and bridges that gap until they could go to the pharmacy. Second, we have to be aware of medication costs. Know the cheaper, effective alternatives. Give generics when possible. A month's supply of generic amoxicillin, Clavulin A, can be significantly cheaper than the brand name. And finally, use your resources. If you have a social worker, a case manager, get them involved. There are wizards of finding coupons, patient assistance programs, or other ways to get patients the medications they desperately need. Ignoring the financial barrier is ignoring a massive foreseeable risk for the patient's well-being.
Yeah, it's so important because it's so easy to just give them a prescription and assume that they're going to figure it out. But I think it's probably good practice just to make sure that the patient has access to a pharmacy, is able to get to a pharmacy, and able to afford the medications and get them and start them in a reasonable time frame. All right, let's bring the case now to a conclusion. The patient is admitted to the hospital and taken to the operating room the next morning by the hand surgeon. And the surgeon's dictated note says that when they opened and extended the wound, a large laceration in the extensor mechanism was found, which directly exposed the joint. And the report says, quote, there was pus within the joint. So the joint was septic. The wound culture result that came back a couple of days later showed Echinella corrodens and Streptococcus viridans, which is the classic human oral flora.
Yeah, it's the signature of human oral flora. The culture is the objective proof that it was a human bite from the very beginning. And the brick story, as you suspected, is a fabrication. The patient ended up requiring 2 to 4 weeks of IV antibiotic therapy and had a complicated hospital course, all from what started as a tiny 1 centimeter cut.
All right, so to wrap this all up, let's kind of crystallize the most important lessons from this case. If a clinician listening today only remembers a few things from the discussion, what would they be, Joe?
Yeah, I think you could boil it down to 3 essential rules. Rule number 1, trust the injury pattern, not the story. An injury over the knuckles of a young person, especially the 3rd, 4th, or 5th MCP, is a clenched fist injury until proven otherwise. Be a skeptic. 2, know the management rules for bite wounds. Irrigate thoroughly. Don't suture the wound primarily. Splint the hand in a position of function. Close follow-up within 24 to 48 hours. And the preferred antibiotic is Augmentin. And finally, rule number 3. Your job isn't over when you hand over the prescription. Acknowledge and address barriers of care. Give the first dose in the clinic if you can. And use your resources to help ensure the patient can actually get the treatment you prescribe. A brilliant diagnosis is useless if the treatment plan fails. Access is part of treatment.
All right, fantastic. So respect the exam. Know the rules for bite wounds. Treat the whole patient, including their social situation. Those are great take-homes. Joe, thank you so much for walking us through this case. And I'm looking forward to the next Med-Mal case. Hopefully we can get Dr. Weinstock on the show to do another case for us.
It was my pleasure, and I'm looking forward as well, Anton. Thank you.
And now a word from one of our sponsors, Paratus, the all-new emergency assistant. Paratus combines everything you loved about Easy Recess with powerful upgrades, just-in-time procedural guidance, stress-proof organization, and Atoms, the intelligent assistant that helps you find exactly what you need. Whether you're in the ER, on transport, or in the field, Paratus keeps you ready for anything. Learn more and start your free trial today at paratusmedical.com/emcases. That's paratusmedical.com/emcases. After publishing our recent 2-part EM Cases podcast episodes on the paradigm shift in stroke management, where it's all about disabling versus non-disabling stroke, An EMK sir, Peter Thompson, had a great question that he posted at the bottom of the show notes for episode 208 about the utility of IV thrombolysis for patients with a minor stroke. So a minor stroke is defined by an NIHSS score of less than 5, but the deficit is disabling for the patient. He argues that the evidence isn't really there for this subset of patients. And then Katie Lynn, one of the guest experts on the podcast, wrote a fine rebuttal that I do suggest you check out. So to get sort of an unbiased third-party view, I asked Britt Long to give us his take on the evidence for IV thrombolysis in patients with minor stroke as defined by an NIHSS score of less than 5, but that is still a disabling stroke.
Thrombolysis in ischemic stroke has divided emergency medicine since the first studies were published in 1995, 30 years ago. Emergency medicine cases covered disabling and non-disabling stroke with Walter Himmel and Katie Lynn in October and November of 2025. Excellent discussions with a lot of gems, but I do want to touch on several areas raised in these segments, specifically the data on IV thrombolysis for stroke in general, but also for non-disabling strokes. Let's get the guidelines out of the way first. The American Heart Association and the American Stroke Association recommend IV thrombolysis within 4.5 hours for patients with ischemic stroke. The 2022 Canadian Stroke Best Practice Recommendations differ a bit. They state that all eligible patients with disabling ischemic stroke who can receive intravenous thrombolysis with either alteplase or tenecteplase within 4.5 hours of stroke symptom onset time or last known well time should be offered IV thrombolysis. That's a strong recommendation based on what they say is high quality of evidence. Finally is the American College of Emergency Physicians. Their 2024 clinical policy gives a level B recommendation that in stroke patients who are candidates for both mechanical thrombectomy and intravenous thrombolysis, thrombolysis should be offered and may be given prior to mechanical thrombectomy, and that if thrombolysis will be administered, it should be given within 4.5 hours from symptom onset. They provide level C recommendations that, when feasible, shared decision-making between the patient or their surrogate and a member of the healthcare team should include a discussion of potential benefits and harms prior to the decision whether to administer IV thrombolysis, and that's a consensus recommendation. These guidelines are based on a variety of studies, including RCTs, and several meta-analyses have attempted to pool these studies together looking at IV thrombolysis in stroke. That includes even Cochrane reviews. The problem is that there are some issues with these meta-analyses, and those limit the conclusions that we can draw from them. First, there's significant heterogeneity among the trials, and there's a selective emphasis on trials that claim benefit with thrombolysis. There's also a great deal of individual trial bias and financial conflicts of interest, and many of the trials were stopped early and had low power. So because of those limitations with pooling the data, I'm going to focus on several of the more well-known individual trials. If we look at the major RCTs published between 1995 to 2012, two studies have reported a benefit in disability. That's NINS-2 and ECAS-3. The 1995 NINS-2 trial with 333 patients found a 12% benefit for IV thrombolysis in 3 hours, and the 2008 ECAS-3 trial with 821 patients found an 8% benefit between 3 to 4.5 hours. But many other RCTs have found no benefit with IV thrombolysis in stroke. We're talking well past 20 trials here. And something that is definitely more certain are the harms. That includes any intracerebral hemorrhage and symptomatic intracerebral hemorrhage. numbers for bleeding vary but can reach upwards of 10%. The more concerning issue is that 5 RCTs have found increased risk of death with IV thrombolysis. Those numbers range between 12 to 16% greater risk of mortality. Obviously, those numbers are an issue, but we do need to take another look at those trials that demonstrate benefit. There have been 2 reanalyses of the data from NINS-2 and ECAS-3. The first one is by Hoffman and Schreiger in Annals of Emergency Medicine, and the second is by Alper in the BMJ. Both of these studies found that the baseline imbalance in stroke severity in the individual studies was probably responsible for the difference in outcome that supported thrombolysis. And when you consider these differences, there is likely no benefit with IV thrombolysis and also a potential risk of harm. Something else to consider is the fragility index. This is the number of patients with a different outcome that changes a study from positive to negative. So the fragility index for NINS-2 was 3, and for ECAS-3, it was 1. Yeah, 1 patient. To me and many others, this questions the validity and the robustness of any data that supports IV thrombolysis in stroke. And when you weigh those risks of bleeding, the issues with mortality, it's even more troubling. What about non-disabling strokes? We have several studies here. The 2018 PRISMS trial, the 2023 ARAMIS trial, and then the TEMPO 2 and PUMIS trials, both published in 2024. These trials defined non-disabling as an NIH stroke scale of 5 or less, and they compared IV thrombolysis to antiplatelet therapy, either aspirin alone or with another agent like clopidogrel or ticagrelor. A 2025 meta-analysis evaluating these trials found no improvement in excellent recovery with thrombolysis, but there was a lower odds of 90-day independence with thrombolysis with an odds ratio of 0.7, an absolute risk difference of 2.5%, and a number needed to harm of 40. Even worse was that there was increased mortality with thrombolysis. The odds ratio was 2.4, the absolute risk difference was 1.5%, and there was a number needed to harm of 66. There are some limitations with this meta-analysis. There was obvious heterogeneity with differing definitions of disabling symptoms, the agents they used, time windows for treatment, routine care strategies, other interventions, and then also follow-up times. Something else to keep in mind is that these trials did not enroll patients with strokes presenting with isolated dysarthria or ataxia, facial weakness, sensory symptoms, and other isolated symptoms not captured by the NIH stroke scale. But even with these limitations, the evidence suggests that the risks of IV thrombolysis far outweigh any benefits in patients with non-disabling strokes. In the emergency medicine cases segments, Walter and Katie recommend defining non-disabling based on the individual patient rather than the NIH stroke scale, which was designed for research purposes. I wholeheartedly agree, and that is one of the problems with the 2025 meta-analysis. Disabling means symptoms that threaten independence or a meaningful quality of life. But for non-disabling strokes, even with those definitions, the current data strongly supports antiplatelets and risk factor modification, not thrombolysis. But even for all types of stroke, I just don't think we have strong evidence supporting IV thrombolysis. Like one of my attendings always told me during residency, the guidelines for IV thrombolysis in stroke are built on a house of cards, but clinically, that leaves us in a quandary. I don't like practicing based on malpractice cases, but the legal implications of not giving thrombolysis far outweigh any complications from the thrombolysis. So, what should we do? My advice is to follow your local institutional protocols. Those likely incorporate the guidelines recommending IV thrombolysis. And of course, make sure you have your neurologist on board. I do think we need guidelines that reevaluate the data on IV thrombolysis. But until that time, I'm offering thrombolysis in eligible patients who have a disabling stroke using shared decision-making. I do my best to present to the patient or a family member the purported benefits and those risks of harm, and I document that discussion with the patient and the neurologist. For non-disabling strokes that don't threaten independence or quality of life, the evidence supports antiplatelet therapy and secondary prevention, not thrombolysis. I know this is a controversial take on thrombolysis, but hopefully it sheds some light on the data behind what we do in stroke. If you want a deeper dive, check out First 10 EM, Rebel EM, and the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. They have awesome breakdowns of the literature behind IV thrombolysis and stroke. And of course, take a look at the show notes for the references and more details.
Thanks so much, Britt, for your take on the evidence for thrombolysis in patients with disabling stroke who have an NIHSS score of less than 5. Let us know what you think in the comment section at the bottom of the show notes for episodes 208 and 209. Now, as the holiday season approaches, I just want to take a moment to thank you and our incredible community. EM Cases exists because of you, and because of your support, we're able to keep this resource free, independent, and accessible to emergency clinicians around the world. If EM Cases has ever helped you on shift, taught you something that stuck, or made you a better clinician, please consider making a holiday donation. Your support helps us sustain our small, hardworking team and keeps Foam alive. You can donate anytime at emcases.com. Just hit the donate button. Thanks so much for being part of this community. All right, for our final EM Quick Hit segment on this EM Quick Hits podcast, we have our final installation of our leadership series with Victoria Myers, and this time we have the incredible Lauren Westafer.
It is a pleasure today to introduce Dr. Lauren Westafer, and we are going to talk about what it means to be a physician leader. Dr. Westafer is a world-renowned emergency medicine doctor, researcher, and educator, and she works clinically at Bay State Medical Center and is the co-founder of another incredible podcast, Foamcast and The Short Coat. Her research is wide-ranging, but I know her best with her specific focus on substance use disorder as well as pulmonary embolism in the emergency department. Dr. Westafer, thank you so much for joining us. It's an honor to be here with you. And as an early career physician and recent trainee, I've really admired your work throughout my career so far.
Thank you. So happy to be here. I've been listening to EM Cases for decades at this point.
Amazing. I guess to start, I'd love to hear about your journey as an emergency physician leader throughout your career.
Sure. I mean, I didn't start as an emergency physician leader, but if we had to go way back, it probably started when I was born an outspoken, aggressive baby, because that's sort of always been my identity. But I came into EM. I love procedures. I love critical care. I love being a generalist, but also a resuscitationist, the surprise of EM. And I came in and I chose a residency because I was like, I know I'm going to do a fellowship. I'm pretty sure it's going to be crit care or toxicology. And somehow in the process that is residency, I came out an implementation science researcher with a sort of side outpatient practice in addiction medicine and a nocturnist. And sort of along that way, I guess I willed myself into being a leader. Like, I don't know. I still think that's sort of an odd title, but I started several projects, which sort of garnered some attention either from funding agencies or from other people. I was just trying to educate myself, like when I got into podcasting, and somehow ended up accidentally educating other people in the process. So I would say it's all sort of an accident.
And I think I hear that from so many leaders, that we don't start out planning to go into leadership and lead the way in whatever we ultimately become experts in. We really start from something that we are interested ourselves and sort of develop this pathway that ultimately ends us up by accident in positions where we are leading or educating other people. And I think it probably, my journey as an emergency physician also started as a loud crying baby.
I love that.
Or a loud feisty toddler, but either way. Okay. So I think it sounds like you have these sights set on a fellowship, critical care, toxicology, and sort of found your way instead into the implementation and research side of things. What do you think changed your course? Was it people? Was it things you're interested in? How did that happen?
I think it's a combination of both, because you have to innately want something in order to probably do it successfully, at least for me. But also, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I've always loved so many things. When it comes to medicine, I love everything. That's how I ended up in emergency medicine. I remember my younger brother was ahead of me in med school a couple of years and was matching. And he's like, I'm going to try to match in ophthalmology. And I was like, why? That's one thing. He's like, yes, but I get to be the definitive expert. And it's like, oh, I just always wanted to do everything. I love medicine so much. But that doesn't really work when you're trying to, like, everyone's like, you got to find a niche. You got to do this. You got to find a niche. And that was like the most mentorship I had is what I thought was people that I respected that were sort of beholden to be my advisors saying, you got to find something. And I didn't intend on doing research, but I happened to work in a place where there were some early career folks as well who were into research. And I think, I don't know, they saw something I didn't want to recognize in myself probably, which was the nerdiness, right? Like I thought crit care sounded cool, talk sounded cool, wilderness medicine sounded cool, but really I'm just a nerd. And I think they helped pull me in. So one of my colleagues, I was actually pretty far along. I decided to do a research fellowship and it wasn't going great. I had, you know, I needed a little more direction than I innately had because I didn't really self-identify as a researcher. I wanted to do it because I wanted to know if I was going to podcast about stuff and I wanted to be able to vet the literature. I felt like an imposter. I was like, I studied Middle Eastern history, which is like relevant in the world now, but not relevant to medicine. I did social work as my prior career. None of this really helps me become a better doctor or a researcher. It's not like I had this strong background in traditional medical research. And so in order to understand the papers, I was like, I'm going to do a research fellowship, and then I will be able to like have some authenticity when I critique papers on a podcast or whatever. And, you know, I was lucky to work with some people who sort of saw me and was like, yeah, but you're really passionate about research, abnormally for somebody who just like wants to have a podcast, and kept intentionally connecting me. She's like, you know, I'm not the right person to be your mentor, but this person is. And she was actually being my mentor at the time. It just turns out like when you work in the world of research, mentorship means a whole different thing. And so she kept sort of pushing me, and she's still like, I just got an email from her like a week ago that was like, hey, there's this opportunity. You know, I wish I had done it. Is it something you're interested in? I think we can make it happen. So over the past decade, she's still been pushing me and helping me find some of those connections that I don't initially see, whether because I don't want to or because they're just opportunities I haven't been a part of.
Awesome. So I hear, I mean, I think everyone can identify with in emergency medicine, loving everything and then getting into training and being advised to please find a niche, which for some of us is far more challenging than others, myself included. The concept of a niche was so foreign to me throughout my training. And then finding mentors that can really pull things out of you that you don't see yourself. So pull a topic or a niche or something that you're really good at that maybe right away you don't really recognize in yourself, and then push you kind of beyond where you think that you're going. And still 10 years later, you're in touch with your mentor who is still providing opportunities, which I think sounds like an amazing relationship. So now how about on the other side of things? How do you approach having mentees and being a mentor? And what lessons do you take from your own mentors when it comes to having mentees?
I think the first thing is that, I mean, I'm still definitely a mentee, especially in the grant world of things. I still very much like see that as part of my identity. So when I work with research assistants or medical students or people, I'm wanting to, I think, help do those things that maybe I didn't get that early on. I didn't get in medical school or when I was an undergraduate or in another place. And so I'm often like trying just to eagerly put out the thing of give them opportunities, not necessarily push things upon people, because you know, some people, like, they have no desire to go in a research direction or whatever, but try to be clear, like, hey, if you want something, you know, I have these opportunities. You can come shadow me at night. We can spend some time together. If you want to learn some of the medicine behind the research we're doing, let's set up a Zoom. We'll chat about that rather than just talking about the data processing or abstraction or other sort of things, if that's what you're interested in. So I try to offer myself up that way. But then also, like, you can't give too much of yourself away, right? If you're trying to step into a mentor role or an advisory role, you can't, our bandwidth is all limited, because I'm trying to make it. I'm trying to, like, you know, keep my marriage and my three kids and my work, and my clinical stuff, and my research stuff. And you start losing things. And so I try to make it clear, like, hey, I have these opportunities. I'm willing to do however much you want and, like, give time to develop you. But I also do need some things from you. And so I've learned to ask for some commitments to do certain things. And what I found is, like, not everyone wants to go through that. That's fine. That's fine. I try to tell people, like, look, it's fine. If you want to be able to just check off putting research on your CV when you apply for residencies, that's okay. It helps me to know ahead of time, because then we can just achieve that one goal. Or if you're really wanting to eventually go into research and emergency medicine, like, let's get some stuff done. Let's get you out there presenting abstracts and being first author on papers and things like that, because I want to build people up. But at the same time, I want to do it because I believe in them and they believe in what our shared sort of mental model, rather than just, you know, giving away time for somebody who really has no clear interest.
Right. So when having mentees, really important that you and them have sort of a shared vision for their future so you can build it together.
Yep.
And it's okay if goals are smaller or a little bit more targeted towards an application or a CV, but at least you then know that and can help sort of think about your own investment in time because you have a lot of other stuff going on.
Right on.
Awesome. Okay, let's change gears a little bit from mentorship, and let's talk a little bit about what it means to be perceived as a leader, and maybe in this way, what it means to be perceived as a leader and how that might differ as physician female leaders to leaders who identify as men.
I remember being told this, and everything became crystal clear the minute I was told women are bossy, men are leaders. And I was told it and initially sort of wrote it off. And then I remember one crystal clear time as an early fourth year med student. And I had done a bunch of EMOA rotations across sort of the Eastern United States. I'd sold them in different, you know, radiology for ultrasound rotations or pediatrics for PDM. So I could get this broad swath of experience. And I was asking for feedback on one particular rotation, because I hadn't had any, and I'm just trying to get better, trying to do things. And they're like, well, if you really want to know, you were seen as too passionate and a little, just too excited about things. And I had this moment where I was really, you know, you go through those stages of, like, I'm defensive, I'm angry, I'm all of these things. And eventually I came away with, like, bless your heart, I will never, you know, go or choose this residency spot again, because I can see that you don't value passion and things. And it took me a while till that person said something to realize that my enthusiasm had been mistaken for sort of an aggression or an abrasiveness, where I think had I been somebody else or carried myself maybe slightly differently, it would have been like, this person is a boss. They are so committed. They are so excited to be here. They will double down 100% and do all of these things. And they are dedicated to emergency medicine. And so I realized, like, it wasn't me. I spent time thinking, what's wrong with me? Why have my evaluations on other places just been like, this person loves EM. They're excited to learn. They're dedicated to this shift. I was like, what's wrong with me? What did I do differently? And it took years until I kind of put that together. So that's something that I've definitely carried along. It's part of my identity, but also something I very much fight against and combat on a daily basis, is that idea of, I can be a leader, I can be excited, I can also be perceived as a five-letter word, but I can, you know, I can be successful, I can do all these things. I can be passionate, but also sometimes perceived as bossy and abrasive. And I have to figure out, how do I meet people that I'm interacting with in a way that they'll be receptive to what I'm trying to do, but also not lose my identity in the process?
I think as women emergency physicians, at times it behooves us to be sort of the louder voice in the room and think about, though, how we can mitigate this perception of us as bossy and instead to be viewed as sort of the boss emergency doctor at the foot of the bed that we all sort of feel that we're being when we're displaying this enthusiasm and passion about caring for a patient or presenting a research project or really any other activities we might be doing. Do you have any tips on how you sort of mitigate that bias when we're working?
I don't know if it's if they're tips, but they're what I do. And the first is it really helped when I had children because I would put a picture up of them next to where I worked. We have like dual split screens. So one is a big monitor is used for like viewing radiology at sort of the attending desk, and the other has the board. And when I'm not viewing radiology, it's pictures of my one and then now three children. And to other people, that made a huge difference. The number of times people would come and just chat with me, spend an extra minute when I'm signing an EKG or ask, oh, wow, you already have that, you know, your child is so big now. And it made me human in a way that I, and reminded me to be human and ask about their kids and do some of those other things where often I would say for better or worse, my wife would probably say for worse, I'm a no-nonsense type of person. I'm like, let's get to it. Let's do this. Like, we're excited about this. I'm at work. We're working. And that has helped me remember that I should take that extra second to establish and make sure I foster those relationships with ancillary staff and my residents and whomever, consultants. It's part of this broader thing that I've identified, whereas I just own it. So I tell people when I haven't worked with them or it's been a while that since I've worked with a resident or whatever, or nursing staff, I say, I am so sorry. I get really excited about stuff. I am so into evidence-based medicine that sometimes it comes across in a way where I'm like, I get aggressive and I never mean it that way. It just sometimes sounds like that because I'm so excited. So just so you know, for the rest of this shift, if I say something or interrupt or something, it's just because I'm so excited, and feel free to call me on it. So I do this like self-deprecating thing, which is, it's genuine. Like, it is true. I do know that about myself. I have lots of realization into that. But also then I don't have to stop being who I am. You know, I can add on additional things and I can sort of make fun of myself. We can have fun about it. But I'm also owning that I'm not going to change. I'm excited. I am passionate, and I'm going to adhere to what I believe is in the best care of that patient or other things that are going on. And so that has allowed me to like keep my identity. And then, so it's like, I'm Lauren Westifer and then some. So I have this like additional humanized perspective maybe, or maybe I'm a little bit funny because I'm self-deprecating, but I can still be who I am, which is what I love. So I can be in a recess. We're starting the cardiac arrest, and I may say, we're not going to pause for pulse checks. We're just going to do rhythm checks because those have been in the guidelines for 15 years. All right. And I preamble with some of those things, and then it conditions them to like, I have strong opinions. That is okay. They're by the evidence, and I've owned that ahead of time.
Nice. And I think that it's important, A, that we can still be ourselves at work. I don't think that there's any strategies we can use to mitigate bias that involves us changing who we are as clinicians and as people and as the passionate medical practitioner taking care of our patient. Just the same way our medical teams, we work with nurses, RTs, learners, we want them to be themselves too. The kind of the point of the team is that everybody's themselves and bringing something different to the table. But it's nice, a quick reminder to stop and to connect with our colleagues, that they get to know you and who you are. You get to know them. It's the same way at my shop. I think we'll wrap up our chat here. Do you have any sort of final thoughts, anything you'd want to share with trainees or young career physicians about sort of paving a path in EM leadership?
I mean, I think for me, I wish I'd latched on to a mentor earlier on rather than waiting for somebody to find me. And I think as much as I talk about being an assertive person, I think that felt like a big ask and it felt awkward. And I didn't know who the right person was because I wasn't quite sure. But I think that it's never too early to look at people that you admire. And maybe they're not the right mentor for you. And you don't have to say like, hey, do you want to be my mentor? But I think paving the conversation of, hey, you know, I could use some guidance. I could use some help in like figuring out where I want to go from here or to achieve whatever, if you know what it is. I know you might be busy. Do you have any recommendations of who might be a good fit for you if it's not you? And, you know, I think that some of those things can be really important. And sometimes it feels like a hard or big or awkward ask. But I think most EM academic folks who teach at residency programs, et cetera, can either help find the person that that could be or can serve as that person.
Amazing. That sounds good. So as a nice wrap up, we'll summarize. I think it's important, as given advice today, it is important to find your mentor early, seek them out, look for people that bring out things in you that you maybe don't necessarily see in yourself. If you have mentees, make sure that you and them shared a nice shared vision of what their future and goals look like so you can help to support them best as possible. And when we talk about mitigating bias when we're taking care of patients in clinical care or in academic settings, it's okay to call out what you think may be a false perception of you and to name it something else. And then that sets examples for all of the future generations that will follow us. Thank you, Dr. Westafer. It's been a pleasure to have you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much. I appreciate you having me on.
All right. Hope you have a great end to your 2025 year. Thanks so much to the EM Cases team, to Sremi, to all of my mentors, to my family, and to you, of course, for a great 2025. 2026 is very exciting at EM Cases because we're hoping to launch the EM Cases coaching app, my dream come true for EM Cases that helps motivate you to learn, fill knowledge gaps, and be more confident in emergency providers. And it'll keep track of your CME points if you want to do that too. We'll be announcing the launch through the EM Cases newsletter. So if you haven't signed up for the newsletter yet, just head over to the EM Cases website and click on the newsletter button. Hope you learned a few things about pediatric urinary retention in this EM Quick Hits. I hope you reflected a little bit on thrombolysis for stroke, picked up some tips on managing fight bites, thought a bit deeper about the triptych of ECG and POCUS, and learned some key nuggets when it comes to postdural puncture headache. Until next time, take it easy.